You're listening to Rethink Northwest with John Roschke and Andrew Bond.
Hi, and welcome to Rethink Northwest. My name is John Roschke, and I'm with Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress. We're a nonprofit grassroots movement to support the progress of renewable energy, not only within our state, but really worldwide. We do focus our efforts in Oregon and the surrounding region in the Northwest. I'm here with Andrew. Andrew, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm here with John today as citizen, layman. I know a little bit about renewables. I like renewables, and I like the idea of citizens being able to make money from renewables. That's something we'll discuss today. But I don't know the most. You know, John, you're the policy guy. You're the technology expert. You've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
You're in the industry. I'm not in the industry.
What first got you involved, or what first got you interested in renewable energy?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in, like, new technologies, and I've realized for a long time that our existing energy infrastructure is old, and, you know, coal, oil, and gas have some major drawbacks, you know, that we don't need to go into. And actually, I was in Germany recently, this past year, and I saw they have tons of solar panels, and it's a cloudy, cloudy place. Mm-hmm. In fact, being a native Oregonian, I realized that it seems just as cloudy as Oregon. What are they doing with all these windmills? It looks kind of crazy. Tons of solar panels. And, you know, I got more and more interested in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I share a lot of your same thoughts there. I've been very interested in energy. It sounds like it's the energy of the future. We've heard that for such a long time.
Yes.
Myself, I've been working in renewable energy for about 4 years now. Came to the Northwest because I was under the understanding that this was really a global leader, is how I saw it at the time, and leading progressive policy. I've worked with a wind turbine manufacturer. I've been a consultant with installers for several renewable energy projects. But lately, I've been drawn into the policy talk because ultimately what I've seen is it comes down to the education for the general public, education for the workforce, education.
Right.
Right now, education for the policymakers and for the decision makers in our government so that we can lay out a better way for renewables to really catch on. We've seen such a wave in the industry coming up and down over the last 10, 15 years, really.
Yeah.
And especially in the last 5 years, it seems to have caught on. Certainly with the election of President Obama in 2008, there was a big surge. But now we're coming down, and we're kind of down one of those valleys for the industry.
Yeah, and so John and I met, you know, some time ago, and we wanted to start a podcast to help provide information for the layman. I'm interested in this stuff, but don't always have time to read the thousands and thousands of words of documents of, like, getting really educated. Mm-hmm. So my interest is kind of partnering with you to make something that can speak to the layman. So I'll be kind of representing the layman's side. And I believe OREP in particular wants to have a voice in the policy, shaping policy.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed partnering with them, and I found them because through my experience within the industry, working again with manufacturers and installers, I came across a lot of different incentive programs around the world, studied them, and I would see where the industry would boom and where it would bust. And there were particular areas where the industry really was taking off. So started asking those questions, not of how do we reinvent the wheel, but let's go out and find out where it's working, mm-hmm. why it's working there,
right?
And let's learn from that. But I was, you know, to be perfectly honest, I was very similar to you 5 years ago. I came out of college, a liberal arts major. Certainly have a technology and a mechanical side of my brain.
I also come at this from a standpoint of conservation. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things we first talked about when we met was camping and hiking and, mm-hmm. and being in nature. Mm-hmm. And the Pacific Northwest has such beautiful natural resources. Often when I would be camping or hiking, just to see big old power lines running through this clear-cut national forest, that, you know, that kind of got to me. And also, like, wanting to have renewable energy for conservation reasons. Is that something you're interested in too?
Yeah, I love the nature side of it. That's how I first became interested in environmental issues. I was actually working in Glacier National Park for a summer in college.
Yeah.
I grew up in Houston, Texas, and until the year 2004, that summer, I thought global warming was still debatable. But there was a 30-minute presentation by a park ranger there. I never did catch his name and never will talk to him again, but that really kind of put my whole life on a different track when I realized the visual impact that the climate change was having on our world.
Yeah.
He went through a series of photos showing glaciers as they were in 1915, 1920, when that park was first founded, versus glaciers in the year 2000. And the clear recession of those glaciers that was there totally changed my perspective. For me, began asking real questions as far as what is really happening on our planet right now, and what are the effects. We've seen recently in the last 5 years a lot more major extreme weather
events, superstorms.
Especially in the last few months with Hurricane Sandy, what's happening on our planet. So that's been a major interest for me. But
yeah,
I was just a layperson myself 5 years ago and managed to get in with some engineering firms and learned a lot more of the technical side of it. But I still appreciate that not everybody is a technical, jargon-entrenched engineer in renewable energy. Lots of us care about this stuff, but we just don't have the time to go get an engineering degree in it.
Right.
So how do we bring this down to the level that everybody can understand, and that's what we're here for this podcast.
Right. So let's talk about our first show and kind of what we're going to do.
Yeah, I think we'll cover first why isn't renewable energy taking off, and again, where is it taking off, and why is it there?
Right.
I think we should also kind of talk about here in America. You know, are we ready for renewable energy?
Mm-hmm.
What do we need as far as infrastructure to be in place so that mm-hmm. renewable energy can succeed the way we've seen it happen elsewhere? Ultimately, what are the obstacles that are there for renewable energy right now?
Yeah, because I mean, it definitely seems like renewable energy has taken off in a certain way in the Pacific Northwest. Like, we have very rich natural resources. We've got hydropower. You know, there's, in some ways, especially in Oregon, renewable energy has taken off. But I think both you and I mm-hmm. are wondering, what's the next level? What's the next step? How can it take off in an even bigger way?
Yeah, and in a stable and sustainable way.
Right.
So that we don't have this roller coaster going up and down and peaks and valleys like we've seen over the last 10 years. Let's see something with continued growth, and let's look elsewhere where it's really taken off and stayed stable and grown year after year after year, and significant goals are being met. Some are even being surpassed.
Yeah.
And how do we mimic that here in the Northwest?
Great. All right, so let's dive into our first topic. What are the obstacles to renewables taking off and being more of our power mix in the Northwest?
Sure, I would say at this point, from my experience and from what OREP has seen around this region, ultimately it comes down to the policy that we have in place and the political will that we the people have to put that policy in place.
Hmm.
So we've kind of sat back, and a lot of us in the early, you know, around the turn of this 21st century, weren't so involved in this process, and we're assuming that everything would work out for us. But we have let other policies come into place that have not been so successful. So ultimately, I think it's the policy and the political will that we need to see. You know, this technology, it's been around. Renewable energy has been around for quite a while. We had solar panels back in the early NASA missions.
Right, we haven't made the investment yet to bring solar or to bring wind or to bring geothermal to the next level,
mm-hmm.
even though it's been around for at least 50 years.
Yeah, the first solar photovoltaic array was available commercially in the mid-1950s.
That's a long time ago.
Long time ago, and you know, even President Carter put solar panels on the roof of the White House.
That's right.
In the late 70s.
That was a big deal.
But then Ronald Reagan came along and he took them down off that roof.
Right.
So had we stuck with it back then,
yes.
There was a big push for renewables around there. There was the oil embargo that time. There was a little bit of fear behind it, which unfortunately that's often the emotion that drives our actions in this country. So there was a little bit of fear behind our energy resources and our energy security. And they started to think about investing in renewables. But then Reagan came along and entered and took down those panels and went a different route with our energy mix.
Right, which goes to the point that I think this has been often a partisan issue. You know, which I hope we can move past that, because when I look at these numbers, and as we're going to go through in this show, we're going to go through some numbers, we're going to talk about details, different policies, I just see big economic opportunities. I mean, I see entrepreneurship opportunities, I see opportunities
Absolutely.
For small businesses, small and medium businesses. This is something that could make our nation a lot more resilient and wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm motivated by wealth as much as the next guy.
Absolutely, and a better economy for our country. I mean, we've seen what's happened since 2008 here.
Yes,
the loss of jobs, the loss of savings and investments that you know, our parents and you know the baby boomer generation has lost much of their retiring savings because the economy's hit such a low and, you know, worst economic period since the Great Depression. And,
right.
And renewables seem to be such a great solution for that. It seems like that could be the next new deal, the next big deal, the next big thing.
It really could be a chance for America to start creating actual value again.
Right.
By building actual assets.
And intelligent assets.
Intelligent assets,
you know, I would love to see a little bit more intelligence in our development.
Right.
We're wise enough, we humans have the intelligence to see the long-term picture, to understand the long-term
consequences
of our actions.
Yeah.
So it would be great to see better and intelligent development in our country, you know.
And in fact, I think that goes to the point of the Pacific Northwest has made some wise decisions in the past.
Yeah.
We made wise decisions to invest in hydropower.
Right.
And way back when.
Yeah, and that's kept our energy prices low. You know, the upfront investment for the hydro dams that are up and down the Columbia River and all around this region, they were an investment, an expensive investment at the time, but those that were putting them in place saw the long-term picture that hydro was a resource that we have abundant and cheap and really free resource that we have here in the Northwest.
Yeah.
They wanted to capitalize on that. They installed the dams. And now we have some of the lowest energy prices in the country.
Yeah, and I have to add that not everyone, I mean, obviously, hydro has its drawbacks. It has some ecosystem impacts, salmon runs. It has some impacts on vegetation. So not, I mean, it's not like it's the perfect technology. But the point still stands that those energy leaders back in the early part of the 20th century, made a decision to make an upfront investment. And we think it's time to do the same thing now with renewables.
Absolutely. You know, and so looking around, you know, where has this taken off and where is it doing well? We really look at Europe. You know, now China has come on and been such a heavy player and their future, as we all know, China's going to play a major role in this 21st century as far as where this planet goes. Both in the economy and climate-wise, China will play a big role. But really, Europe has been the leader in successful and proven renewable energy development.
Right.
And again, the sustainability, it doesn't just come and go. It came, it arrived early around the year 2000, maybe even before that, and has really taken off and continued to grow year after year. And they've been one of the healthier economies in the last few years.
That's right.
You know, you look at Sweden actually has 49% of their energy is coming from renewable energy. Latvia, Finland, Austria, all in the 30s and low 40% of their energy mix is coming from renewables. Germany, who in the year 2000 only had 6.3% of their energy coming from renewables. Again, in 2000, Germany only had 6.3% of their energy coming from renewables. Just in early 2012, they hit the mark of 25%.
That's amazing.
25% of their energy is now coming from renewable energy. So, you know, they've set that target. They set those high goals for themselves, and they're really exceeding some of their goals.
Yeah.
You know?
And that just goes to the point. I mean, I think they're positioned to be a strong economy with cheap energy well into the mid-century because they've been so consistent with their policy.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 10 years. And we're going to talk about the power of what policy they chose a little bit later on in the show.
Right. You were mentioning that you spent some time in Germany on vacation.
Yep.
And did you see much renewables around?
Solar panels everywhere, as I was saying. And wind turbines everywhere. In fact, on my birthday, actually, we ran up a hill to a wind turbine. You can walk right up to them, and they're, you know, massive, majestic, a little scary, but, you know, I would rather see a wind turbine than a huge smokestack.
Sure.
Spewing toxic fumes into the atmosphere.
Great.
So they're definitely everywhere. And one of the things I noticed in Germany was, and we actually drove around quite a bit. We drove into Austria and some other places, you know, nearby. Quite a lot of solar panels on roofs. And a lot of clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of clouds. In fact, it felt very much like the Pacific Northwest.
Very similar.
Yeah, so my question is, they have clouds, we have clouds. They're making plenty of power from solar. How does that work?
That's a great question. And we're not even close to their production.
Right.
Yet we have very similar clouds. People say, well, Oregon can't do solar energy.
It's too
cloudy. The winter's there. But that's not true. Actually, the least sunny area in Oregon, that namely is Astoria up there in northwest Oregon, has the least amount of solar resource available. Yet that still has more sun than Germany.
That's crazy.
We're not talking about Phoenix, Arizona here. Right. We're talking about Germany. Cloudy right. Germany, just like the Northwest, yet they're the solar leader of the world.
Sure.
And they've managed to grow this resource with a cloudy environment, just like the Northwest. So there's no excuse as to why we can't do it here as far as the technology goes and as far as the resource goes.
So what is the situation in Oregon right now? A lot of listeners may or may not know that most U.S. states have what's called a renewable portfolio standard.
Mm-hmm.
So our portfolio of energy, some percentage has to come from renewables. Where is Oregon now? What's our progress like? What's our mix like?
Sure. In Oregon here, OREP has compiled some data from the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, and it shows that Oregon's energy mix has 42% of our energy, at least as of 2011, 42% of our energy comes from hydro. So we mentioned how plentiful that resource is here, and yes, we've developed an infrastructure to really tap that resource. So 42% is from hydro, yet still 34% of our energy is coming from coal. You might ask, well, we don't even have any coal burning plants here. I never see any coal burning plants in Oregon. The one coal burning plant that we do have is out in Boardman. And that's scheduled to be shut down by 2020.
Great.
Where is this coal burning electricity coming from? And the answer is it's coming from out of state. We're buying dirty energy from Montana and Idaho.
Wow.
And that's being piped in or transmitted in. That's the electricity that we're using here in Portland and around the state is dirty coal energy.
So wait, we have hydro. We have some wind in the gorge. Like we built up some resources. And we're still buying coal power from other states.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're paying them.
Right.
That doesn't quite sit right well with me.
And the renewable energy we are generating, we're shipping that electricity down to California because they have their own renewable portfolio standard that they have to meet.
Uh-huh.
And so earlier their policy was that they could buy it from anywhere.
Okay.
They've changed that, and California is now supporting their own California-grown renewables.
Great.
As OREP believes we should do for Oregon. We should buy our Oregon energy.
Yeah.
But some of this energy, even all the wind turbines that we see in the state, some of that electricity is leaving Oregon and going down and out of state to other places.
So this brings up an interesting question of local energy generation. And I've heard some things about transmission losses. In other words, the farther you have to ship the power, the more you lose.
Right.
Along the way.
Yeah.
So that's one reason we might not want to buy from different states.
Exactly. Yeah, there's more cost there. There's when you have such long transmission lines, that's just physics.
So yeah, transmission losses. What are other reasons that we might not want to buy power from other states? I mean, including the fact that it's not a clean source.
You know, obviously, that's our money is leaving the state. And the Oregon governor, Governor Kitzhaber, his report came out and showed that 85% of our energy dollars in Oregon are leaving our state. 85% every single year.
Wow.
Now that includes transportation, but just in energy dollars, that's $4 billion a year is leaving our state every single year because we're buying energy from out of state. Or out of state contractors, out of state developers have come into our state and set up these energy power plants, be it renewables or not.
Right.
And they're taking those proceeds that they make year after year and those energy sales out of our state.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of money that we're losing out on. And imagine if Oregon Department of Transportation, ODOT, had more money to improve our bridges. You know, I just read a report that with the certain policies not passing, with certain policies failing in on the ballot in November, the Selwood Bridge isn't going to be able to get fixed the way that we had wanted to. And that Selwood Bridge is not looking so good right now.
I think that's the most dangerous bridge in the world.
Okay,
so back to energy. So we're talking about Oregon's energy mix, renewable portfolio standards. Let's talk about jobs. This is a hot topic right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of need for job creation.
Absolutely. Every politician will tell you they want to create jobs. And what better way, what more intelligent way to create jobs than supporting a clean, green infrastructure? Germany, with all that increase, again, when they went from 6% renewables in 2000 to 25% renewables in 2012, from 2000 to 2010, Germany created 370,000 clean energy jobs within their economy, thanks to renewable energy and the policy that they put in place.
That sounds pretty good. I think I can think of a lot of people that would take a renewable energy job.
I can think of a lot of people as well, you know, and they've moved. They never really saw that type of impact. They certainly realized the environmental impacts. They were close to Chernobyl when the nuclear disaster happened there.
That's right.
That was close and up close and personal for them there in Germany. Yeah. They saw acid rain in their forests in the late 90s.
Wow.
And that's what really spurred this development, what really kind of gave that scare to them and the political will to pass renewable energy policy that would succeed. But they didn't really realize how fast this could happen. And really all around the world, we're seeing places where the transition is happening quicker than they ever thought possible. Better benefits, more jobs, all this stuff is coming together. And we could do that here. We could copy their good ideas and bring that success here to Oregon. Because again, Oregon is a leader, and people see us as a global leader in sustainability, certainly as a leader in America for sustainability here in the Northwest.
True.
And people are looking at us to lead.
Yeah, so it's time we do that.
So, you know, so then that begs the question, well, why not? Are we ready for it? Do we have the infrastructure for this improved renewable energy world that we all want to see? The short answer is yes. Right now, we could make some improvements with renewable energy on a distributed level, that being smaller scale projects. But there's no doubt that our energy infrastructure is outdated. You know, we talked about the dams that were built up and down and all the projects that happened, you know, in FDR's term, and the infrastructure improvements that he brought on and that around that era came online, rural electrification and all that. But that's the last time our power grid really got a major rehaul and a facelift.
You know?
So I don't know if you've noticed, but our energy uses in our society have changed just a little bit since the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, we need a 21st century grid. I mean, it seems like we should make that investment now.
Yeah, and we've all heard about this smart grid. We talk about the smart grid, but there's still debates as to what exactly that means. But no doubt, what we need is something that can balance the variability of renewables. We all know the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine. How do we create a grid that can balance that load and always provide that base load? You know, our society has what you may have heard is called the base load. That's kind of the minimum requirement of steady electricity that we need to run our street lights at night, to run, you know, the offices that are open 24 hours a day. There's that base load that we have to meet. And if we come, you know, certainly in the middle of the night, there's no solar energy available. And what if it's a calm night? What do we do? So we need to meet that base load somehow. And that's the challenge that we need to rethink. That's the problem that we need to solve. And there's ways to do it. And again, we can look around and see other places that have succeeded.
It seems that one of the solutions is going from this very centralized model of one big power plant, one big nuclear plant, one big coal plant, sending electricity, you know, hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away, what I saw in Germany was very distributed. Like, there's solar panels on every house. There's wind turbines scattered all over. They're not necessarily in these huge farms like we see in the gorge. So, can we talk about what's the difference and what are the benefits and drawbacks?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot of people, when you say renewables, for a lot of folks, what comes to mind is those large wind farms we see down in Columbia Gorge, where you just have fields and fields of wind turbines. Critics are always quick to bring that up, talk about the view shed issues. They don't like looking at it. They don't like hearing it.
Right.
They don't want it in their backyard. People don't like that. So why not do it on a smaller level? You know, why not just have it on every single house? That's what Germany has done. And that's what allows a more distributed and balanced energy
generation
around.
And that's better because a small, like, if you're feeding a couple, I don't know, is that kilowatt hours? If you're feeding a couple of those into the grid from your house, it's easier for the lines to accept it than connecting a 300 megawatt wind farm.
Right, and even our outdated energy infrastructure, you know, when I was working on the residential level for wind and solar projects, you know, just plugging in a 3 kilowatt residential solar array, that doesn't pose much of a problem for balancing loads for the utility companies. Yeah. They never reject those projects. They've learned that it's safe. They've taken care of the interconnection issues. But really, you know, as you're saying, it's going away from this centralized energy generation model that we see in fossil fuels. And
yeah.
The reason why we have that centralized generation model in place is because that works great for fossil fuels.
Right.
When you have just one plant that you have to ship your coal to, say, or one plant where you have to pipe in your natural gas, one place where you burn that gas, you burn that coal, one place where you can easily hide the smokestacks and the environmental negative effects that that you have. You can do them in one place, a lot more easy politically. You know, you can get it up and maybe people don't fight that. And you have your centralized power plant. And then also one place that you have to pipe your electricity, transmit your electricity out of. It makes it a little bit simpler.
Sure.
And certainly from a corporate perspective, you can consolidate your costs. You just have one maintenance crew that's in one location.
Right.
You just have, one place that you have to ship all your materials. So logistically, that just works better. And because it's a fuel that can burn on demand, you don't have to worry about the availability of that resource. As long as you have a railroad track leading to there or roads to get there, you'll always have the resource coming in. You just burn it and you can generate your capacity at all times. That doesn't really work for renewables. You know, you may have heard in the Columbia Gorge, they have a problem a lot of times because on really windy days, there's actually too much power.
Too much power.
All those wind turbines that they've put there are all working at max capacity, and the power lines don't have the capacity to handle all that electricity, so they have to shut off half the turbines.
Which sounds inefficient.
Inefficient, and the developers that put up those turbines are losing revenue. They planned on their turbines, you know, generating a certain amount of energy due to those high windstorms, factoring that in.
Yeah.
Now they're not making those kilowatt hours, and they're losing out on those revenues, and there's been lawsuits filed against Bonneville Power Administration for them shutting down turbines and refusing to receive that power. Also, in the high water runoff times in the spring in the Northwest, when all those dams have to run because the water is building up behind them, and when you run those dams with high water levels behind, there can be negative effects on the fish and the wildlife in the river. And so they have to let those dams run at times. And if they're running those dams and using the transmission lines to transmit that hydroelectricity from the dams to our city centers, there's not room on those transmission lines for all that wind power.
Right.
So we see that happen. Then the opposite side of that is what happens when it's a calm day in the gorge. Then you have all those wind turbines, all these transmission lines, and zero power
coming out
of that area.
Inefficiency.
So, you know, you want to space out your projects so that you have lots of small projects geographically distributed around an area.
Yeah.
So that on a partly sunny day, let's look at solar. If you have a partly sunny day, which happens once in a while here in Oregon, you can always have energy feeding onto the grid from one location. If you have 100 small projects on a cloudy day, you'll always have, you know, probably 30 to 50 to 60 of them running at one time or producing at one time.
Yeah, Jeremy Rifkin in his book, Our Third Industrial Revolution, makes this comparison. And this is the counter argument. Distributed generation works great for a distributed resource, which wind is, which solar is, which most renewables are distributed. Rivers are distributed. Geothermal is distributed.
Right.
Why don't we have our generating technology match the nature of the energy resource?
Right.
That seems obvious to me.
And then a nice little byproduct of that is if you have generation all over the area, you're probably going to have a generation site close to a user site.
Right.
So you're going to have less transmission.
Right.
If I have solar panels on my roof, then the transmission is probably 20 feet down to my sub panel.
Right, exactly.
Versus a big giant solar array out in the high eastern desert, which, yes, there's lots of solar resource available out there. And yes, some of those projects are needed. They might be a little bit cheaper to have out there, but then you have all those transmission costs.
Sure.
You know, so we need a hybrid of both those large utility scale renewable projects, but also the small scale distributed projects to really balance the load. And that would go a long way in helping us rethink our power grid here in the Northwest.
Yeah, I think that just makes sense. And also, I mean, one of the things I loved about what Jeremy Rifkin said was, if you draw a 100-mile diameter circle around any point on the globe, there's power, there's renewable power, whether it be wind, wave, sun, you know, geothermal, there's always power. So I think if we get used to thinking in that distributed mindset, it'll be a lot better.
Yeah, it's going to mean that we're going to have to see our energy generation.
Yes.
So that goes, we have to rethink our priorities. You
right.
know, we want, I'm certainly not advocating no more electricity. I love having my cell phone.
Love my power.
I love my laptop.
Yeah.
I love all the luxuries that we have in our society. I don't want to stop that. But because we need electricity to power those things in our lives, that power has to come from somewhere. And
right.
That's what it takes to power our society. So that's just kind of a reality that we need to come to grips with.
Agreed. So speaking of looking over and seeing your neighbor's solar panel on their roof, what's actually possible? Just to give an example, what's possible with rooftop solar, for example, in Oregon?
You know, an average residential project, I would say, is about 3 kilowatts.
Okay.
Maybe is pretty safe assumption. Some folks have huge roofs. Some folks have lots of solar resource available, and maybe they can go larger. Some residential projects are even as big as 20 kilowatts.
Wow.
But you know, an average two-car garage solar project is probably going to be about 3 kilowatts.
Okay.
So that's going to generate you about 3,000 kilowatt hours a year. Average Oregonian probably uses about 800 kilowatt hours a month. So 800 times 12 months is 9,600 kilowatt hours a month. So you could generate about a little bit less than a third of your energy from a rooftop solar array on your two-car garage. It's not going to be everything to power your energy bill. It's not going to be everything to cover your energy bill, but it will be a significant chunk. And then if we can have that on top of investing in some renewable energy projects on the utility scale, we'd see a significant increase. Well, and to state first, our Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard, we're shooting for 25% of our energy mix coming from renewables by the year 2025, which is really right around the corner.
Great.
Environment Oregon came out with a study that shows that 10% of Oregon's energy needs could be met by rooftop solar and by utility scale solar. So solar power
by 2025.
Could be
wow.
10% of our energy by the year 2025.
Even in rainy, dreary Oregon.
That's pretty huge. Yeah.
Do you know by chance what it is right now? Probably less than 1%.
Yeah, right now it's less than 1%, easily.
Yeah,
You know, the energy mix in Oregon, 34% of our energy is coming from coal, 14% of our energy is coming from natural gas, 42% is coming from hydro, 3% is coming from nuclear. Renewables are the rest. You know, less than 5% of our energy is coming from renewable energy. And of that, less than 1% is solar right now.
Okay.
So to jump from less than 1% of Oregon's energy right now in the year 2012 to an increase of 10% of Oregon's energy coming from solar by the year 2025, that would be a huge increase. And imagine the jobs that would come with that.
Yeah, that would be wonderful for the state economy.
Yeah.
Okay, it seems to me we've talked about local energy. Oregonians like to buy local.
Absolutely.
We're stoked about local food. I mean, that's a big deal. I love the farmer's market. I love eating at restaurants that have local food. It seems like we would go for local energy, too.
People understand that local food is better for our environment. Why should an orange be cheaper if it comes from Chile than from right down the road in California? Why should an apple from
New Zealand.
Australia or New Zealand be more affordable than an apple from right here in the Northwest? That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense. It's healthier for our bodies. It's healthier for the local environment because we're paying local farmers
mm-hmm.
to feed us.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's an analogy there. We could pay local energy farmers
right.
to feed us, potentially.
Right. So we think about these centralized energy power plants. You have one big power plant generating all this electricity, and then it gets fed out in every direction to power every city center around.
Right.
That's the model that we use, and that's, again, the model that works for fossil fuels.
Right.
What we're suggesting for energy is that we have lots of small projects spread out across the state so that there's points of generation all around and all kinds of energy coming into the cities from all different directions and even from within the city itself, right here on rooftops of downtown.
Absolutely. And there's a couple good things about that. One of that is there's no single point of failure.
Mm-hmm.
So a big windstorm can't wreck all the turbines in the gorge and suddenly we're out of a bunch of electricity.
Right.
Or, you know, terrorists can't blow up a dam and then we're suddenly out of electricity.
Right.
So distributed means resilient. The other good thing about that, that, you know, talking about local food, maybe really think about this. In the industrial food system, you know, when there's a huge valley and it's a monoculture of just Brazil nuts or just, you know, lettuce.
Yeah, we see that all the time.
Right. California Central Valley or whatever, right? And then this produce is shipped all across the nation, you know, thousands of miles away. That's a centralized, industrialized food system. Mm-hmm. And there are some big drawbacks to that, including the local ecosystem starts to fail because it's a food desert for animals. And in fact, in some of these inner cities, certainly poor areas, there's food deserts for people too, where the only food they have access to was shipped in from hundreds or thousands of miles away. So it's kind of analogous to centralized energy generation. And by extension, if we are in favor of local food, distributed food, in other words, food that we can eat that's grown close to where we live, it stands to reason we should also be in favor of buying local energy. I mean, before you get up in the morning and have your breakfast, you use electricity before you eat
right.
breakfast.
Right, but where does that electricity come from?
Idaho and Montana.
Yeah. A lot of it's coming from out of state, and we should certainly know how to support local businesses, and a lot of Oregonians are willing even to pay a little bit more for that local good, for that
That's
local
right.
product.
That's true.
So that they know it's going to support their local economy and grow local business, and again, it's the same thing with renewables. We should be supporting local energy generation where we know where the product was harvested,
right.
We know who owns the production,
that's right.
We know how far it had to travel
yeah.
to get from production to our plate, or in this case, to our plug.
And we might even know the guy who we're paying.
Right.
I mean, indirectly.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about what are the obstacles. I mean, I'm convinced. I'm sold. I'm sold on distributed generation. I'm sold on a more resilient grid. Mm-hmm. I'm sold on wind and solar, renewables.
Right.
What are some of the obstacles we're facing?
Again, the political will. Really, and laying out some successful and proven policy that we'll cover next time as to what these other places have done. We need to have the political will. And really, we the people need to demand that we not buy dirty fuel, and that we not buy fuel from far away. We want to buy our locally generated, locally owned power. So the political will certainly needs to be there. But in the Northwest, we have it more here than in other places in the country. Certainly there's other issues as well, permitting, you know. A lot has come up lately about gun control and the
right.
debate there, and we're not
yeah.
going to get into that. But my question is, why can you walk into a store and buy a gun and have all the background checks and walk away with a gun in 2 or 3 days? Do you think you can get a solar panel in 2 or 3 days? Do you have
probably.
Any idea what the permitting process is for a solar panel?
I don't think I want to know.
You can walk into a car dealership, and in an hour and a half, you walk out with a $40,000 car. Why can't you walk into a solar installer and walk out with $40,000 worth of solar panel installation on your roof?
Wow.
It just doesn't happen that easy. There's far too many barriers in the permitting process. And again, I think the critical mass, if there was a better policy and a true accessible and reliable incentive for folks to get renewable energy on their property, I think the critical mass of so many people demanding that, these permitting issues would work themselves out. But at the moment, permitting barriers exist that just don't make it very simple. And for all of us who are busy, we don't have time to spend hour upon hour trying to figure out how this all works and
right.
what applications we have to go for. And when I helped a customer install a wind turbine, you know one of the questions they asked me was?
No.
How many toilets in your wind turbine?
You're kidding.
How many toilets in your wind turbine tower?
And I assumed there were zero toilets.
There were no toilets. Not in that one. No.
Okay. Good to know.
No. So, the point is, though, is I was filling out a form as if I was building a garage.
Wow.
Because there is no form to build a wind turbine.
That seems
so if we had a better permitting system,
yeah.
That's an extreme example, although that happens all over the place. They also asked me about the torque ratings up and down the tower. They didn't ask me about the torque ratings to bolt that tower down to the ground. That's
wow.
kind of important. We want to make sure the tower doesn't fall over.
Right.
So it's not only the questions that they are asking, it's the questions that they're not asking. They
right.
never ask me how loud is my turbine, because you never have to ask how loud is your garage.
Right.
But that is an issue. Some turbines are manufactured in not the best quality. And so there have been horror stories that we all hear about in the news. It's a great controversy to report
sure.
on a loud, noisy, disruptive wind turbine. So we hear about that.
Right.
So we should ask that question in the permitting process. That's
right.
not always there. So permitting is certainly an issue. Also workforce development. You know, in 2008, 2009, when there was a big surge in renewables, we didn't have the contractors and the installers trained and ready to install these projects. Now that those folks have gotten trained, and by 2010, 2011, we have a bit of a workforce ready. Now the incentives are gone, and the installations aren't there, and those contractors that spent 6 months to get trained have no jobs to do it.
So
their businesses have closed down, or they've focused back on their old business. They're not doing the renewable energy installations that they were trained for, that were available back in 2009 when they weren't trained for it. So, you know, there's kind of a chicken and the egg question there.
Sure.
We certainly need the workforce developed as well. Financing needs to become available. There are better solar lease programs you may have heard of, and we'll cover that in a future show certainly as well, what options are out there. But there needs to be, solar energy needs to be accessible and available to all Oregonians, not just the wealthy, not just those that have the time and the resources to go out and figure out how to pay for this, how to permit this. This needs to be available to all Oregonians. That certainly is OREP's stance.
Yeah, and it sounds like, really, there's just a lot of barriers to entry. We just need to open the market up and make this more, you know, more free market, more American.
Yeah, and so for Americans, what it really comes down to is the incentives, the financial incentives.
Yes.
And that's, I think, and OREP is really working on, the major obstacle is let's get a serious, stable and reliable financial incentive so that it is worthwhile for people not just to feel good and hug a tree, but to make some money, and to save some money, and to make some money with renewable energy.
And I just have to say, I'm so behind this idea of being able to save money and make money with renewables. And people, they think about, well, why should we have to help out this industry? And I just want to go on record and make the point that a lot of people don't know. I didn't realize this until very recently. The very mature industry of coal, oil, and gas is still receiving billions of dollars in government subsidies. It's a mature industry. It's very profitable. I think we should be able to shift some of that government help to a new industry that's demonstrably good for everybody.
Yeah, it's definitely not a level playing field right now. People say, well, renewables shouldn't receive incentives. They should be able to stand on their own. It's a free fuel source. Why can't you do that on your own?
Coal, oil, and gas are not standing on their own right now. They
never have, and they never will. Yeah. If you can explain to me how it's cheaper to generate electricity by mining fuel on the other side of the planet, or maybe just on the other side of the country,
shipping
that fuel across the country, then bringing it into a plant, then running the power plant, then generating electricity, why not just build the power plant where the resource is? Why not put the wind turbine where the wind is? Why not put the solar panel where the solar is? Go ahead and take that whole first portion of the life cycle of energy fuel. Let's take that out of the equation. And how is that cheaper? You know, just as it's, how can it be cheaper to bring up a Chilean apple than an apple down in the gorge?
Right.
How is it cheaper to bring in Middle Eastern, or how is it cheaper to bring in Alaskan coal to generate here? There's a disconnect. Something's not even, and the truth is, it's because they're receiving subsidies.
It's the incentive.
They're not doing it on their own. There's an incentive there for them to do it. And these businesses have some very smart lawyers and financial teams that have figured out how to make this work thanks to the subsidies in place.
Right.
If we put some subsidies, if we put some incentives in place that made it worth their while to figure out how to make renewables work, this would take off just as we've seen it in Europe, faster than we could even imagine.
Absolutely. So I think next show, we're going to talk more about what are those incentives, what is the policy that OREP is advocating for, and what is the policy that the average homeowner should stand behind if they want a fair shot at being an energy entrepreneur.
Yeah. So we thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more, please log on to OregonRenewables.com. That's OregonRenewables.com. That's Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress website. It gives you tons of resources, tells you about what these other countries have done, tells you about what we're trying to do here in Oregon. Feel free to click to donate to support our work in the state. And we'd love to have you come back and listen to our next shows and learn more about renewables here at Rethink Northwest.
John, it was a pleasure to do this show with
you. Always is.
I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Great. Thanks so much.